Music from Buddy Green, the song Virtuous Woman. And before that, from Janet Paschal, Sweet Life. And good morning to you. 12 and a half minutes after the hour. It's a Wednesday, and we know what that means, don't we, David?
Yeah, we do.
I just want to see if you were paying attention. You were.
No, I am paying attention. I just looked over at the screen, and I've got two pictures of you and one of Doug and one of me. I mean, it's just...
You're surrounded by friends, then.
My computer's going crazy.
That's good. We welcome Doug Greenwald from right on the very edge of the center of the world, which, of course, is Washington, D.C. And Doug is the Executive Director, Senior Teaching Fellow at Preserving Bible Times, which is a ministry based in Washington, but you travel all over the country, don't you, Doug?
We certainly do, and it's a treat for us to go to any state and any city in any church in this country and open up the scriptures and start to teach people and equip them to how to engage the Bible in its original context so we can get closer to discerning the original meaning of these passages that we are familiar with but may not be totally familiar with.
Well, you've got several different kind of packages there, aren't they? Are they basically weekend teachings, 2-3-day events?
Well, we've learned that most people will give you up until Saturday noon. So a lot of our teaching weekends are really Friday night and Saturday morning. We'll get about 6 hours of teaching in that time. And yes, we have several teaching programs, if you will. Our most popular one is probably called Bible Alive. All of our programs are multimedia, and they're meant to equip people as well as to give them a new paradigm, if you will, about a new pair of glasses about how to read the scripture. We have another one called The Last Days of Jesus, The Greatest Story Never Told, which is 6 hours of contextual teaching on John 11 through the end of John, which works wonderfully well for Lent. For those churches that want to have a rekindle an emphasis on discipling, we have one weekend called Making Disciples Jesus's Way, Wisdom We All Have Missed, because it takes a contextual look at what Jesus was really doing from about a 5,000-foot level perspective and gets us a little bit above ground level. And we start to see some patterns and some methodology and some approaches and tactics that Jesus uses that I don't think we in the West have particularly put into view. And that can be a really exciting weekend. And then one of our more recent ones comes out of the study program trips that we annually take to Israel on the life and land of Jesus, is I've been learning more and more about biblical geography and biblical culture. And so we have one called the Bible, : its culture and land, where we do much more intensive work in biblical geography and biblical culture. And more and more churches are bringing us in to teach that weekend to get their people ready for a trip to Israel, or for people who've already been, to give them an integrating experience to tie a lot of things together and connect some dots for them. And for the third set of people, to give them a taste of an Israel trip, even though they may never get there and may never leave the church. And we also do some specialty things, like in Advent, we have one called Meet Zachariah and Elizabeth, which is a conceptual restoration of Luke 1. And that's about a 75-minute multimedia program teaching. And sometimes that's followed, and sometimes it's a separate event on Luke 2, what we call Christmas in context, the real birth of Jesus. And then we will do specialized teaching, like for, say, a Young Life staff training or a Youth for Christ staff training or a pastor's retreat or a church retreat weekend that wants a very particular emphasis, say, on the prodigal son for a men's retreat or something like that. So we actually have, handful.
Quite a variety, yeah.
Yeah, 8 or 10 things that we can do. And, of course, we can always do something special if there's a particular emphasis that a church or a ministry wants to take. But all of these have the same common denominator. We're trying to get past our typical one-dimensional Western evangelical way of thinking about these texts, these narratives, and these passages, and engaging them like the people who first heard the words would have understood them, and that makes it sort of three-dimensional. And we start to see more challenges, more insights, more applications, more implications than perhaps we've ever seen before, and we realize that those stories that we thought we were familiar with are still is a whole lot left there that we can still benefit from.
And that, of course, is why we take such delight in having you with us on Wednesday mornings. How's the calendar look? Can churches still arrange for a visit yet this year? Or is it, how far out do you have to plan for that?
It all depends on the weekend you want. You know, some weekends are very popular in the spring and fall, and you might have to go out 18 months or 2 years.
Oh.
But if it isn't one of those weekends, we could literally do it within 6 weeks. So it just depends on the timing and the program that the churches want, whether it will or won't fit into our existing calendar at that point in time.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes we end up moving very quickly.
Well, I'd suggest a visit over to the website, preservingbibletimes.org, learn some more. And if your church has a weekend free, I can't think of a more exciting thing than to have Doug come out with one of those weekends, one of those training sessions that he's just described, and get more people involved in this, because, it, as I say, it's a delight. I mean, you just peel back layers of fog that rests on top of my Bible, and I see things I never knew were there.
And I think the point I'd like to make, not only is it interesting and fascinating information, but that's not why we do it. It's because it gets us more closely aligned with the original meaning of a passage, and therein we'll find much more of the transformational power always intended by the Holy Spirit for that passage. And so these are not just informational weekends. These are spiritual refreshment, deeply devotional, and oftentimes transformational weekends for the people who come.
I'm looking at a three-dimensional map that we've posted on the website under our tab that says Holy Land Views. And this is a map that's available from Preserving Bible Times. In the last couple of weeks, we've been talking about the topography of Israel. And Doug, knowing the topography is one of those things that is involved in context, isn't it? The lay of the land, how the history of Israel developed, and how it affects our understanding of what we read.
Well, as we've been talking for the last, whatever it's been, 2 or 3 weeks, a great first question to ask of any passage that you're going to ponder is, where are we? And that, of course, is an intensely geography question. And where are we, that which means the site, the locale, the region, often is a part of the intended message or a part of the intended understanding. And so that's why we started there as the first question to ask in our ground level pursuit of how do you open up a passage. And there are many, many implications to that, some of which we've discussed over the last 2 or 3 weeks. But I think maybe to kick us off this morning, I'm going to make some, call it macro observations again, get back up at 30,000 feet and look down on Israel in the Middle East, eastern end of the Mediterranean. And even though this is a little country, which we talked about before, and even though this country is sandwiched between always a powerful northern neighbor and a powerful southern neighbor, Egypt in the south, Aram or the Aramaeans in the north, who can be Assyrians or Babylonians or Assyrians, depending on the century we're dealing with here, God nevertheless did some fascinating geographical things with this country to help protect them. For example, if you look back in history, Egypt never invaded Israel from the south in any meaningful way, because the whole Sinai Desert is just a natural barrier to protect this nation from invasion from the south. If you were going to do the invasion, you'd have to really narrow down your focus and come along the coastal plain there, along the edge of the Mediterranean. But in terms of a mass invasion, the whole southern region of the Sinai, which is basically desert, is a natural buffer zone, if you will, that God put there to protect Israel. And then, if you look at Israel, and from the west, you've got the Mediterranean Sea. Well, back in times of antiquity, except for the Greeks, who were forced to be seafaring people because they lived on islands, Rome's not a port on the Aegean Sea or any of the other major seas, and so it's going to send its armies around by land. That's why the whole Roman interstate road system was put in place for transportation purposes. They will resupply by ship in certain areas of the world. And so the very fact that Israel faces the Mediterranean Sea to the west is another natural protection barrier from invasion by military forces. And then, if you look at the eastern side of the country, You've got this deep depression called the Jordan Valley Rift, and then you've got this 2,000-foot escarpment on the Jordanian side, which was Moab and Edom in biblical times. And then that's a natural barrier for any invasion from the east. I mean, no army wants to come along and then have to go down 2,000 feet and then cross the Jordan Valley Rift and then have to go up 1,000 feet on the Judean wilderness escarpment to continue your approach towards Jerusalem. So it's been absolutely fascinating to me to notice how, from a macro geographic perspective here, God actually put some natural buffer zones, some natural protectedness in the geography, in the topography of this land to help protect the people who were in it.
Of course, that leaves the north. One question I wanted to sneak in, though. How far is it across the Negev, the desert, from Egypt to where the green starts, to where the mountains start to turn green and we get into sheep herding country? That desert is how big? What was the barrier to the Egyptians?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on where you come from in Egypt and where you're heading, but, you know, anywhere from 60 to 100 miles probably.
Okay, so to get a mass of troops and chariots and horses and all the attendants across would be a huge thing, and so they would be pretty well restricted to the coastal route, which I guess would be comparatively easy to defend.
It is, and that's why you'll find fortresses like Lachish, where they are, because that's where they know if there's going to be an invasion from the south, it's going to come along the coastal plain.
Okay. And then the north. What of the north?
You're right. And you walked right into that one. If you're going to invade Israel, you invade it from the north. And as millennia in history have shown us, whenever there's a significant invasion of Israel, it comes through the north. Within the nation of Israel, it comes right down the Jordan Valley Rift in what was known as the Hula Valley back then. And that's where Hatzor is, because it's meant to protect an invasion from the north. And once you get out of Israel into Syria, this sort of natural country sort of veers to the northeast and goes towards Damascus. So the typical invasion route always has been coming in from Syria from the northeast and then coming due south through the Jordan Valley Rift or up on the Golan Plain and invade this country. And even in the 1973 war, several thousand tanks flooded from Syria right down that Golan Plateau and right down the Hula Valley into this country of Israel. And within several days, they were all knocked out in probably one of the biggest tank battles in the history of military warfare. But true to history, the invasion came from the north, and that helps explain why Israel is so persistent or persnickety or however you want to use those words about maintaining control of the Golan Heights, because the Golan Heights isn't just a height, which it is, but it's also a raised plateau. In fact, it's 12 or 13 miles wide in certain points of that plateau, and so you can see how tanks could come roaring through that plateau and then veer down into the Jordan Valley area there on an invasion. And so once again, topography explains not only what's happened, but actually helps us understand some of the current political issues and military concerns even today.
Now, historically, between the northern and the southern kingdoms, Judah and Israel to the north, when after David's reign, after Solomon's reign, when they divided into two kingdoms, they became very different in their religion and in their cultures. Was that due to a difference in population, a mix of cultures? Why was the North so different all of a sudden?
Well, you know, when we get to geography, we also have to veer off into what's known as physical geography. And one of the components of physical geography is rainfall. And we may have talked about this a little bit before, but if you draw a horizontal line across Israel, where Jerusalem is, and then once you get to Jerusalem, sort of make that like a 45-degree angle line that goes to the northeast, you have just drawn a line that encompasses 75% of the land of the country, but it only captures 5% of the rain. And so if you go to the north of that line, that imaginary line that I've just drawn, you only have about 25% of the country, but that region gets 75% of the rain. So the rainfall dictates what you can do where you are. And so that's why we primarily got shepherds in the south, and why over time we're going to have farmers in the north. Very different people, develop very different cultures, if you will. Life is much more difficult in the south. It's easier, relatively speaking, in the north because you have decent soil, you have adequate rainfall, you can get good crops year after year. You can provide for yourself, so you don't need to lean on God as much. Down in the south, you're very aware that if Yahweh doesn't deliver the rain, you're in debtor's prison. You're just a drought removed, and you're just one insect infestation removed from disaster. And so the very nature of the rainfall, coupled with the poor and the better soil, dictates what you can do where. And the kind of where you live directionally dictates the kind of spirituality you're going to have, whether you realize you have to lean on Yahweh or whether you think you can provide for yourself. And that's a pretty significant geographical backdrop, backstory, if you will, to the northern and the southern kingdoms. Now, there's other issues going on here. The international highway only comes through the northern part of this country. It skirts Judea in the south, and that's the avenue that new ideas for new gods and new worship patterns come into the land. So you're much more vulnerable to syncretism if you live in the north, the influx of new idolatrous ideas. If you live in the south, you're much more protected by the geography from those kinds of influences that come into the land. And so when you put all of these pieces together of physical geography, it really helps us explain the differences in the spiritual destiny and the spiritual condition of the people who live in this land. That's why geography matters.
And it's been a mystery to me why the Assyrians, basically, in my understanding, kind of stopped after conquering the northern kingdom. Was it just simply a more attractive, a wealthier prize for them than the southern kingdom would have been?
Well, you remember they couldn't get Jerusalem. That was the whole period of Hezekiah. And so they controlled enough of Israel. By controlling the north, you control Megiddo. Mm-hmm. You control Megiddo Pass. You control the international highway. You control the major trade route that comes through the Jezreel Valley. All of these warfares are about trade, about commerce, because that gives you control, power, and the ability to tax, to generate revenue and income. And so from an economic point of view, the north was far more strategic than was the south to the Assyrians, because once you controlled Megiddo and you controlled the coastal plain, you had 90% of what you were really looking for from an economic perspective.
And yet they were stopped militarily, then, we're saying, by the walls of Jerusalem and Hezekiah's planning and defense.
Yeah, and of course, that lasted for a little over a century. Mm-hmm. 586, the Babylonians came down and conquered the southern kingdom. So they held on longer, the southern kingdom did, than the northern kingdom, but eventually they fell as well in 586 BC.
Well, of course, the northern kingdom, in effect, was a buffer for them.
For the first round, if you will, because they fell in 701.
Yet Egypt did play a role. Necho, was it? The pharaoh who came north and attacked. So they were a desired object from an Egyptian standpoint too. I mean, Israel's been fought over forever, it seems.
And that's because if you look at the map from 30,000 feet, you realize that Israel is the land bridge that connects three continents. It's where the crossroads of the world. That's why everybody wants to control this place. Now, it's more important to control the northern part of the country than it is the southern part of the country. But if your army is powerful enough, like Alexander the Great, you don't even make those distinctions. You just defeat the whole place.
Mm-hmm. So what's next for Israel? Because Revelation indicates that invasion will come from the north, doesn't it?
You know, when we get into Revelation, I do what I used to do in my basketball days. I put one hand 90 degrees on top.
Time out. King's X.
Time out. And and there are very diverse thoughts, feelings, opinions, and perspectives on end times. We leave that to others, and we just stay focused on biblical context.
Okay. Well, maybe that's a good thing. And as Doug's been talking, I've been looking at that 3D map. Again, if you're looking at the Broken Road Radio website, up at the top, there's a Holy Land Views site. Now, we post all of Doug's conversations as podcasts, so you can go into the audio archives, and I've just learned that I can also link the picture of this map to the audio broadcast. So anybody who comes in and listens to the rebroadcast, the audio file of any of Doug's conversations on this map will be able to see that map. Click the link and see a picture of the map. This is still available from you, isn't it? People can still purchase this.
Absolutely, and it will be for quite some time.
Okay, and there's a phone number on the map, on that page, that if you're interested in purchasing this three-dimensional map of Israel, you can contact Preserving Bible Times by telephone. That's the only way you can order it, to my knowledge, right? That's still the case, Doug?
It is, because we're trying to figure out how to deal with the much more expensive shipping cost in the web computer part of our life here.
So okay.
We posted it on the website.
Okay. Well, and there's been a lot of activity off of our website on that. So if you're interested, it would be a neat thing to have and quite a study aid, really, in understanding, you know, applying the knowledge of topography to your study of Scripture. Doug, where do we go from here?
Well, I'd like to finish off our time this morning by taking you to the north, to the Sea of Galilee. And as we've talked about before, for Midwestern kind of people, at least upper Midwest kind of people who are familiar with lakes, it's much more a large lake than it is a sea. Let's just pause there for a moment. How do words evolve like they do? Typically, there's a relationship here. The more you have of something, the more words you create to create subtle differences. So, for example, the Eskimos have like six different words for ice.
Mm-hmm.
They got so much of it. So there's soft ice and hard ice and ice storms and that kind of a thing. They all have different names. But if you have very little of something, like water in Israel, you typically only generate one word. You don't need multiple words. So, you know, for those of us who grew up in the Midwest, we have ponds and lakes and seas, and each of those, and puddles. And each of those four words denotes a different size, if you will. But if you have very little water, you only need one word in Hebrew, and that word has been translated sea. So it's the Dead Sea, and it's the Sea of Galilee. Mm. And there really aren't any other lakes, ponds, puddles around, so you don't need very many Hebrew words to differentiate between the two. So that's how the word sea gets end up used to describe what you and I would know as a lake. I'm sure that information didn't change your life, but
well, it's a big shallow dish, isn't it? I mean, it reminds us of our Mille Lacs Lake up here, which is probably not too far off in size.
Well, I'm not sure. Maybe you have a lake like that in Minnesota, but we don't have a lake like that in Michigan, because this lake sits at the bottom of what we would call a big cereal bowl, and it's 700 feet below sea level. That makes it a pretty unique lake. But I don't want to deal so much with the geography of it per se, as I want to deal with the political geography, if you will, we can use that phrase, around the Sea of Galilee. And what I want each of us to do, to envision in our mind, is we're at the southern end of this lake, which is, as we look north, is 13 miles long. And as we scan side to side from east to west, maximum 7 miles long. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And down there, we're going to call that like a clock. We're going to call it that we're at six o'clock, and the far north end is noon, and we're going to progress around this lake in a time sequence manner. So I want to start us at 9 o'clock in the morning. And from 9 o'clock until noon, we have the northwest quadrant around the Sea of Galilee, and that's where we're going to find the religious Jews. Or perhaps a more technical word would be called the observant Jews. These are the people, deeply religious, who are into behavioral religion, who have rabbis who tell them what they can and can't do, and as well as how they can do it and about it. These are scrupulous people in terms of behavior. They're trying to do everything right that they can. And these are the religious Jews, the observant Jews of the first century. And one of the main cities on the coast there in that northwest quadrant is Capernaum, and that's where Jesus makes the headquarters for his ministry. So Jesus sets up shop in what we call observant Judaism, very religious northwest corner quadrant of the Sea of Galilee. Now, if we go from noon to 3 p.m., we have moved over into Hellenistic Judaism. And these are Jews who want to have things both ways. And so they will go to, on Shabbat, they will go to the synagogue and they will worship. And the other 6 days of the week, they will indulge themselves in all the pleasures of Greco-Roman life. They're having it both ways. They're fencers, if you will. Lukewarmers, if you will. And the observant Jews who live between 9 o'clock and noon absolutely despise the people who live from noon to 3 p.m., the Hellenistic Jews. Because of their loose living standards. Well, now if we go from 3 p.m. all the way around the bottom to 7 p.m., we are now dealing in an area called the Decapolis. Deca for 10 and polis, the Greek word for city, the 10-city confederation. This is what's left over from the Alexander the Great period of time when he imported Macedonian city-states as part of his subjugation strategy for this part of the world. And these 10 city-states function in a loose confederation. And some of the names we're familiar with, Gadara, Garagasa. Some we might not be so familiar with, Scythopolis, Hippus, Pella. But in this part of the lake, down in the south, let me get my map here, my southeast quadrant, if you will, of the Sea of Galilee, this is the world of the Greco-Romans. This is the world of hedonism. This is where if it feels good, do it. If it tastes good, eat it. If it looks good, touch it. Okay? And so, in my mind, this is where the prodigal son went when he left Capernaum on the other side of the lake. And the biblical writers talk about a far country that the prodigal son went to. It's a morally far country, an observant Jew. It has nothing to do with distance. And so a far country could be a day and a half's walk away from home in Capernaum. And so you've got this kind of life going on here. And then from 7 o'clock again to now 9 o'clock, we have another pocket of Hellenistic Judaism. It's where Tiberius is known to set up today. Hellenistic Judaism is where Levi came from, for an example. He's a Hellenistic Jew. And so when we think of a lake in Minnesota or a lake in Michigan, that's a large lake, we automatically think that the people on the other side of the lake are just like us. I mean, we're all Michiganders or we're all Minnesotans. Mm-hmm. And we all go to the IGA supermarket and, you know, we all eat at the same fast food restaurants. There's just a commonality of people on one side of the lake to another. Not true in Jesus's time. So we can't bring that sort of implicit assumption along. We have to realize and recognize the diversity of the geopolitical climate that surrounds this lake. And that's another good reason why we always want to ask, where is Jesus when he says what he says and does what he does? Because of these various perspectives, if you will, that surround this lake. So, for example, one day when Jesus has finished teaching and healing, he says to his disciples, probably about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, get in a boat, we're going to the other side. It's from Luke. And the other side is a code word that observant Jews use for the Decapolis, because they know they can't say the word Decapolis or it will make them ritually unclean and send them to the purification baths. And also, these disciples, who 10 of the 11, 10 of the 12 are observant Jews, know that an observant Jew is forbidden from setting foot upon Gentile land, and the Decapolis is Gentile land. So, you know, understanding how the Sea of Galilee is made up, what the phrase the other side references, what the Decapolis stands for, is all part of the backstory here of the consternation that the disciples would have had when Jesus says, get into the boat, we're going to the other side, and we're going now, that they had to be almost in anaphylactic shock. you've got to be kidding. We can't do this. We're forbidden to do this. Jesus, you know, as an observant Jew, we cannot set foot on foreign soil, Gentile soil. This is the land of evil. Satan is viewed as the chief operating officer of the Decapolis. I mean, surely you're jesting here, Jesus. We can't do this. That's all part of the backstory to these passages. All, again, hinging on the question, where are we? And in this case, where is Jesus going to take them?
And again, it's demonstrated how knowing some of the context, even the topography, the geography, and the cultural influences around the lake, just light up Scripture, bring it into full color and into three dimensions. And it's just it's a wonder. It's a wonderment, as they used to say. Doug, we're grateful to you for the map and the stories and the information and the teaching. And thanks for spending some time with us today. We'll look forward to doing it again in a week or so.
Well, I think we're about to shift gears. Now we're going to ask the question, what cultural clues do the Bible writers give us? And so I want to start to develop some cultural backdrops of how villages work and village lives works, so that, again, we can be better equipped to look at these passages with a different pair of glasses the next time we read them and ponder them.
And we'll look forward to that. We've been speaking with, Dave, did you have I heard a noise from Dave there. Do you have a question?
I exploded a guttural there?
I think that was what that was.
Yeah. That was what I did. One of the things that, you know, that I was thinking about while you were talking, Doug, is that I've always had, and I just realized this, I've always had this mistaken notion that there was only about 15, 20 people in the area while Jesus was alive. I mean, it's in 15 or 20 was an exaggeration, but I've always, I don't know where I got the idea, but I've always thought of it as a very sparsely populated area, and it's not true. And you know, it's far from true. There were a lot more people there than I'd ever even thought about. I don't even know if it was a concrete thought, but yeah, the stories that we learned as kids never really talked about a huge number of people living in that area.
Now, we start with Bethlehem, and we're always told what a small little village it is, and it's true. And I think we maybe project that to everywhere else that we end up. But Capernaum, for example, probably had at least 5,000 people in it. The Decapolis cities like Gergesa and Gadara were 10 to 15,000 in size. I mean, these are pretty substantial cities. I could show you some aerial photographs of some of these, and you begin to see how expansive these Decapolis cities were. So I'm glad you made that point. But yeah, typically we're dealing with cities here that are at least several thousand in size, and a number of them are greater than 10,000 people in size.
We were watching footage of the fighting in Aleppo last night on PBS, and you know, one of the things that struck me was how people are living cheek to jowl. I mean, they are, you know, the cities are jammed. I mean, it just, you know, it's, you know, you hear stories about people living in 15 to 20 in a room, but you don't really put it in perspective until you actually see it. And you know, the apartment buildings are just jammed, and you know, there's thousands and thousands of people in a small neighborhood. And yeah, so it's changing the notion of the way this area was populated, and kind of changing the background and the context of what you're, you know, of the stories and all the things that you're talking about. You know, this geography is another aspect.
Yeah, and I'm glad you made that point. That's a segue for next week. But one of the things we're going to realize is these, even in a small village like Bethlehem, basically the houses just basically almost abut to each other. Common walls. And one of the implications of is there are no secrets in these towns, in these. And that all plays into some of our understanding of how to interpret the parables. You know, the reason the prodigal son in that parable, the reason the father has to invite the village elders to a banquet is because the younger son, in demanding his share of the inheritance, not only insulted his father, he insulted the village. What we fail to understand is that when the elder brother fails to resolve this issue between the younger son and his father, which he is mandated to do because he has the birthright, which the elder son has, everyone in the village knows that he's failed in his obligation. There are no secrets. And the sin... Mm. not only against the father, the sin is against the village, because not only has the father been shamed, but the village has been shamed. And that's why the father has to throw a banquet, because he needs reconciliation, not only with himself, with his son, but his son has to be reconciled with the village as well, who he has shamed. And so this whole backdrop of what's a village like and what are some of the implications of that just has deep implications for understanding some of these passages and parables.
And we will look at that in some additional detail next week. Doug Greenwald, Senior Teaching Fellow and Executive Director of Preserving Bible Times. Do feel free to visit that website. You can link to them from BrokenRoadRadio.com, where perhaps you're listening this morning. Link over on the right-hand side of the page, and you'll find that they're just a valuable resource for your church and for your own Bible studies, your small group discussions. And, well, Doug, we'll talk to you in a week, okay?
Great.
Be blessed. Thank you very much. Music on a Broken Road Radio Wednesday morning from Paul Kelly.
We are gathered here today to join a woman.